This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Gwen Dyer, author most recently of Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats. Gwen Dyer, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt.
You've, I understand, had the distinct honor of previously writing about the other great crisis facing the survival of the Earth, which is the risk of nuclear annihilation, nuclear war. How'd you get on that, and how do things compare now on the nuclear issue?
Yeah, sort of a catastrophe junkie. Okay, first of all, I'm a journalist. I do a twice weekly column. I need something to worry aloud about. But no, I think that I came to it legitimately. I mean, back in the Cold War, there really was something to worry about. The fact that we got away with it doesn't mean we might have been destroyed. Might not have, you know, I mean, it could have happened. It didn't happen. And one of the reasons it didn't happen is that both people who invade against the weapons and the people who control the weapons made it not happen.
But we got awfully lucky. I mean, we were lucky during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Exactly. And, you know, I used to be in the military, and I know a little bit about what those things can do. So, you know, what we had there was a problem which was technological in its nature, but human in its solutions, political in its solutions. Frankly, so is this one. You know, the physics and the technology and all that of climate change are what they are, but the way we make it through this without a catastrophe or don't is still get the politics right. It's never anything else. And, you know, so but specifically, how did I fall into this one? Well, you know, I mean, people who write columns have to have sort of butterfly minds. They hop from one subject to the other rather easily, short attention span. And so I don't actually hurl myself into 2 years of research as a rule. I just sort of move on. And once in a while, I do hurl myself into something longer form because suddenly it really gets your attention. And this happened to me in Washington about 3 years ago. I go to Washington a couple of times a year because you have to, right?
You live in London, right?
I live in London, yeah, but you have to go to Washington and figure out what they're up to. And I was staying with an old friend, actually, and it just sort of came up in the conversation that the Pentagon was getting interested in climate change. Well, why, says I. Dunno, says he. But I went on and got in touch with some people in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, actually, sort of the planning, the brains of the Army, if you'll pardon the tautology.
And this was during the Bush administration where there was denial.
Absolutely. Outside, I mean, they weren't saying anything for publication at this point. I mean, it's a career killer to take climate change seriously in 2007. But they were, of course, looking at it quietly in the back room because, first of all, it was an emerging threat to American security, and second, or maybe the other way around, it was where the money is coming from in the defense budget 15 years from now when we're no longer, you know, in Afghanistan and worrying about terrorists and things like that. What's the next job?
You say that's a minor threat compared to this one.
Oh, well, terrorism is a minor threat. I mean, it's the whole point of terrorist strategies is to make it look like a major threat so that the opponent overreacts. It's all about getting the other side to overreact and do stupid things like, oh, you know, invade Afghanistan or something, because then we got them. Well, that's not the case with the climate change thing. We're not reacting enough. And it could give us. I didn't realize that at first. I just thought, this is interesting. The soldiers are getting involved. I went back to London, actually, and checked it out. And, yes, the British soldiers were starting to look at it as well. That's where I first heard the word, the phrase Lifeboat Britain, actually, which is still really confined to strategic circles in the United Kingdom. But it's what it means is when things get really bad because it's got too hot and the refugees are on the move and we can't grow enough food in the world anymore and the people closer to the equator are suffering far more than the people further away, you're going to have floods of refugees and you're going to have hunger. So what do we do to keep ourselves safe? And the answer is we're an island, so we can just pull the drawbridge up. We can deal with a refugee problem. And we're pretty far north, and so if we went absolutely flat out, we could probably just about feed ourselves from our own resources. It's Lifeboat Britain, and what you don't let is refugees to swamp it.
So, but that would mean a humanitarian disaster of turning back boat after another of refugees.
But my kids before yours.
And that's kind of the dog-eat-dog world you're projecting here, Gwynne Dyer, and climate wars, the fight for survival as the world overheats. And you also aren't actually ruling out the possibility of nuclear war, which was your first real
first
obsession.
Yeah.
And it's not a global kind of annihilation that you're depicting, but a strong possibility, at least in India and Pakistan, that there would be a nuclear war caused by global warming that would result in 400 to 500 million people dying. What's that scenario?
Well, if there were a full-scale nuclear war between India and Pakistan, that's about the likely casualty toll. I mean, bear in mind, I've said this, I can't remember, about 20 years in the future, which means that their arsenals are much bigger than there are today. We're now talking about 50 weapons on one side, maybe 80 on the other, but they'll be in the hundreds, if not in the thousands, by then. So, yeah, of course, that's it's a pretty densely populated part of the world. Start blowing off nuclear weapons, you kill a lot of people. But what causes it in the scenario, and you understand scenarios are not predictions, they're possible futures, not definite futures. What causes it is the fact that as the glaciers that feed the rivers of Asia melt, and almost all the big rivers of Asia are fed by glaciers up on the Tibetan Plateau, and they're melting. Everybody, the Chinese Academy of Science says that on average they're losing mass at the rate of 7% a year. So they're gone in 20 years, effectively. The higher-level glaciers up Mount Everest will be there for centuries, but not the ones that keep the rivers full. And the river that Pakistan lives off of is called the Indus. I mean, it really does live off it. As much as Egypt lives off the Nile, 85% of the food grown in Pakistan is grown on land irrigated from the Indus River. They depend on that absolutely, but it actually crosses India before it gets to Pakistan. And there's a deal about how you divide the water, and at the moment Pakistan gets about 70% of it and India gets about 30%, which is fair, I guess. And certainly it's got to be that way if Pakistan's going to go on feeding its population. But the treaty that says this is how we divide it doesn't say 70-30. It just says you get the water from that tributary, we get the water from this tributary, and because India is giving you this and that and the other thing, they get a fixed amount of water out of these rivers here that otherwise go to Pakistan. Fine when the rivers are full. That gives you 30% as India's share. If the rivers are half empty, India's entitled to the same volume of water it always was, even though it's now 60 or 70% of what's there. Are the Indians going to say, shucks, poor Pakistanis, let's be reasonable about this, we'll only take half our share, that the treaty says? No, of course not. Government had collapsed. India's going to be short of food, too. I was in New Delhi about a year and a half ago, and I was interviewing the head of a think tank in India, and she just sort of dropped into the conversation. The fact that she just finished a contract for the World Bank, which had come to her think tank and said, can you figure out how much food production India loses at 2 degrees Celsius higher average global temperature? And she put her people on it, went back and told the World Bank 25%. So if India is losing 25% of its food supply, it's not going to be reasonable about these rivers, but if it doesn't actually let Pakistan have most of the water that's left, Pakistan dies. And you got to assume that by the time you're in this situation 20, 25 years from now, there really isn't any international grain market anymore. You can't buy your way out of trouble by importing food, because the big grain exporters haven't got any to export anymore. You've seen this with Russia this year. One really bad summer, and they lost 30 to 50% of their grain crop, and they're not exporting. Australia already has, frankly, lost its wheat lands. And, you know, world's second largest exporter 10 years ago, now down to practically nothing.
Because they dried up.
And have finally come to the conclusion this is not an ordinary drought. This is climate change. This is the new normal. So farm families are giving up. I mean, if you can't believe in the future, go find a different job. In giving up in large numbers in Australia. Therefore there will be no way out for, let's say, Pakistan if it can't feed itself. There is no international grain market left that can supply its needs at any price. I can get you a nuclear war out of that.
So they'll, they're going to want to grab the water.
They've gone to war over water before, and they weren't even facing mass death as a consequence of not getting it.
And the idea that the temperature would rise 2 degrees Celsius is not out of the question by any means at this point.
Listen, most of the scientists I talk to think we are going to be very lucky if we stop short of 2 degrees Celsius, because, you know, there's an awful lot of momentum in a society like this. You've got the technologies available to cut our emissions, but actually putting them into effect, weaning people off the present fuels and getting them some other source of energy, there is resistance. The sunset industries do not go down quietly. And it's just a lot of investment, a lot of work shifting us over from here to there. It's like turning a super tanker. It takes a lot of time. And, you know, we're on a track here that's going to deliver us to 2 degrees higher. Probably within 20 years.
And we don't have a lot of time, as you're suggesting. And the estimates keep getting overrun by the facts. You have a statistic, Windeyer, in this book, Climate Wars, that said 5 years ago, scientists were predicting the melting of the Arctic Ocean in 2050. Well, it's happened already.
Yeah. The numbers are always – the numbers that come out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the numbers we all use. It's an international gathering of scientists paid for by governments, supposed to provide sort of advice to governments. We're not dealing with mavericks here, but the numbers that come out of that are always low. There's reasons for that, which are sort of built into the system, and we haven't got time. But I don't know a single scientist active in the field of climate – who believes the IPCC numbers. They are all operating on significantly higher figures, significantly faster change. I'll give you an example that's not a scientist. I was in the Netherlands about a month ago because the Dutch version of this book was coming out, and I generally write one scenario about the country, you know. So I don't know enough about the Netherlands. So I went and I did about 3 or 4 days research, and I interviewed a bunch of people, including the head of the Delta Commission, which is responsible for, you know, building the dikes up to deal with sea level rise. So I said, what numbers are you using? Knowing that the IPCC number, which is what everybody uses, says maximum sea level rise by the end of the century, half a meter, okay, a foot and a half. He said, well, we're working with somewhere between 3/4 of a meter and 1.5 meters, so we just go with a higher figure. That's three times what the IPCC says. And, I mean, they're investing very large sums of money in this and building to that standard because they really don't believe the numbers that we're given in public. Well, this applies right across the board.
And that is one of the horrifying things about reading this book, Windeyer, the author of Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. The frightening thing, one of them, is that you talk to scientists and you talk to government officials who are dealing with these concerns, and almost to a person, they were saying things are much worse than people think. They're much worse than the scientific statistics that are coming out of the the organization that you mentioned, and we don't want to talk about it out loud, basically.
Well, except that some of them are just sort of throwing off the harness and talking about it out loud. There's a really interesting thing happened in October and November last, just before that big conference in Copenhagen in December, which was a train wreck. But this was an attempt to get people's attention before the conference, and it was probably the most respected climate research institute on the planet, which is the Hadley Center in Britain, founded by Margaret Thatcher, no less. And, you know, the right wing isn't anti-climate in Europe or elsewhere. Actually, it's purely an American affectation. They came out with an estimate of where we will actually be, never mind the IPCC figures, in 50 years' time, on a business-as-usual basis, which doesn't mean we cut nothing, but that we cut at about the rate we're cutting now.
And what'd they come up with?
They came up with 4 degrees higher average global temperature in 2060, only half a century from now. My kids will still be alive, let alone my grandchildren. And 4 degrees higher average global temperature is most of the way to where the IPCC says will be worst case at the end of the century. So really what they're saying is, you know, and by the way, the British government backed this. The British Foreign Secretary was there to present these numbers from the Hadley Center. Now, they were just trying to get the donkey's attention before Copenhagen, but the numbers are real. They did something else, which is very interesting, and most Americans probably weren't exposed to it because it was not aimed at them. They published a map which translated 4 degrees higher average global temperature, and you understand I'm talking Celsius, so that's 7 degrees Fahrenheit, into what it would actually be like in various regions of the land surface of the planet, because that's very different. You know, I mean, when you say 4 degrees average global temperature rise, you're mixing in the two-thirds of the world that's ocean, where it's relatively cool, and the one-third of the world which is land, where it is much warmer on average. So what is it on land when you have 4 degrees average global temperature? And the answer is a lot more. In the case of the interior of the large continents, like sort of the center, North America, the United States from the Appalachians west to the Rockies, it's 7 degrees Celsius, 12 Fahrenheit. Now, I don't know if there's still agriculture operating in this area. I mean, I don't know if it's still raining. You know, the United States will probably always be able to feed itself because it'll always be raining near the coast. And the coast will be somewhat cooler because the oceans have this cooling impact on coastal land. But the United States as a food exporter may not last this century.
So that's another reason why you think there'll be global food shortages.
Yeah.
And there'll also be flooding. And you talk about Bangladesh, which is a country that is risking drowning. And the hundreds of millions of people there risking drowning so badly that India is putting up a wall, which seems like one of the most immoral things to do because it's worried about the refugees from Bangladesh running into India. You have a guy, a scholar from Bangladesh in here in this book, Wind Dyer, Climate Wars. The scholar from Bangladesh talks about Bangladesh's climactic genocide and says that people in the West should start adopting Bangladeshi families.
Well, you know, for every megawatt of power you consume, you take in a Bangladeshi family because you just drowned them otherwise. No, it's absolutely true that, you know, some countries, particularly low-lying countries in the tropical regions, are really at tremendous risk. You know, I actually talked to, among other people, not just the scientists, but the head of the Bangladesh Institute for Strategic Studies. You didn't know such a thing existed, did you?
Well, I imagine most countries have those, but
I didn't
know
this
one. Yeah,
that's right. He's a retired general. He's a very bright guy. And we had a rather far-ranging conversation about, what are the strategic implications for Bangladesh? And, of course, the wall you talked about came up right away. You know, we can't become refugees. The Indians have trapped us here. But he used this analogy, what's going to happen is that the fresh water we depend upon for our crops and our drinking is going to dry up because the glaciers that feed the rivers that flow through Bangladesh are going to melt, and then there will be no water in the summertime, except, of course, the seawater coming up from the sea level rise. So we'll sort of be thirsty up to our knees in seawater.
So they're damned two ways.
Damned if you do and damned if you don't. Damned both ways, no matter what you do. So, they go around in circles trying to figure out how to do something about this, and they don't get very far because it's actually not they who have to do it. They're not emitting much carbon dioxide.
Well, that's the other point, or one of the many fundamental points that come out of this book, Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival. As the world overheats, my guest is Gwynne Dyer. This is Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. That point is that the Western standard of living is non-universalizable, if you will. Or as you put it in this book, if all the rest of the world's people attained a Western standard of living, we'd need 3 to 4 planets to live on. And so this gets to one of the basic moral grievances that the developing world brought to the table in Copenhagen, which you rightly called a train wreck, and that is this: the demand for compensation or climate debt, as it's sometimes called, for third world countries that aren't contributing to it but are going to bear the brunt of it. And part of the climate debt would be a payoff not to use the most destructive technologies. But so how come this wasn't a sell, or this needs to be a sell? You say this is the big, the grand deal that needs to be made.
Okay, yeah, but I mean, let's consider it for a minute. Now, the deal, and everybody in Copenhagen knew what the deal would be. If you make a deal, this is what it will look like. If you don't, it can look like anything you like. But there's only one possible deal that will get its way through here, and that is because the rich countries, with maybe 1 billion of the world's 7 billion people, we're at it for the last 200 years, industrializing, getting rich, and pumping all that gas into the atmosphere. We are responsible for 80% of the problem, though there's only a billion of us. The other 6 billion, 6.5 billion, 7 billion, whatever it will be by the time the worst of it hits, some of them are now industrializing and beginning to put out a lot of carbon dioxide, like the Chinese and the Indians and the Brazilians and Mexicans and so on. Many of them aren't industrializing at all, but in any case, the historical debt, the burden that we bear, is what we did. So if we are going to have a deal, it's got to acknowledge that. So we, now being rich, have got to cut our emissions fast and deep, while the most you can ask of them is that they cap their emissions where they are now. Because frankly, even now, Chinese people on average emit 1/4 of what Americans emit. So Americans cut deeply, and the Chinese stop where they are now, and there'll still be probably a 2- or 3-fold difference for another generation. And you also have to let them go on growing their economies, even though they've capped their emissions. So all the new energy generating capacity they put in has got to be clean. It's got to be wind or solar or nuclear or whatever, you know, but not oil, gas, or coal. Well, almost all of the alternative forms, the renewables and nuclear and so on, cost more. Who pays the difference? And the answer is, we do. Okay. Imagine that deal had been made. President Obama goes to Copenhagen, he signs it, he comes home, and he goes on television, he says, "My fellow Americans, we've saved the planet. I have agreed that we will cut American emissions of greenhouse gases by 40% in the next 10 years and a further 15% in the following decade. We're going to be completely out of emitting greenhouse gases by 2040. And there will be tax implications, of course, and perhaps some job implications, and entire industries like the oil industry will have to close down. But it's worth it because so much is at stake. And, oh, I should mention, we'll also be shipping $50 or $60 billion overseas every year to people like the Chinese so that they can grow their economies with clean energy. I know there are trade rivals, but still, it's only one atmosphere, and we've got to vote for me." Hey? It's not a starter.
Not a starter. But so you asked the question earlier on in our conversation, Gwynne Dyer, how do you get the politics right then?
Well, it's a starter when the voters understand why it is necessary to say what I had Obama say. And we're not there yet. We're not there yet, not just in the United States. You're probably further from the promised land than anybody else in the United States. But we're not there in Europe. We're not there in Japan. We're not there in Russia or India or China. The knowledge is there among the scientists and actually among many of the politicians and the military. The implications are clear. But they're not willing to go public with it. They're not willing to be treated as some kind of nutcase. Nobody wants to be Al Gore. You know, look at Obama now. Obama knows what's going on. Look at the people he hired. John Holdren is his chief scientific advisor. Stephen Chu is his energy secretary. I've interviewed many of them. They understand the problem. They see the problem more or less the way I was laying it out to you, because it's a consensus among scientists.
It must be awfully frustrating for them then. They're like the defender who sees the ball going into the net and can't stop it.
I know, but you see, he hired them because he shares their views, and yet he can't do anything. You can't get too far ahead of the troops you supposedly lead. And Americans aren't willing to go there, so he can't. Look what he does instead. He can't get anything through Congress. So he uses regulations rather than laws. He uses the Environmental Protection Agency, and he raises the requirement for fuel efficiency in American-manufactured vehicles hugely over the next 7 years, 6 years now. By 2016, fuel efficiency has got to be 35 miles a gallon. You're starting from 21.5 miles a gallon. So what are you doing? You're having your emissions from the American vehicle fleet is not growing. Everybody in the country's already got a car, unless they're too young or too old or in jail. But, you know, everybody else has one. So the fleet's not growing. If you increase the fuel efficiency, you cut the fuel use. The United States could stop importing oil when you get to there. So there's ways to do bits, move the agenda forward. But, you know, you do need legislation in the end, and American public won't support it yet.
And we don't have time, though. That's the nub of the question. You also say, Gwynne Dyer, that those of us who are, you know, studiously changing our light bulbs and driving our Priuses out there are practically irrelevant. Why is that?
I would probably rephrase that in the next edition. Because it's not irrelevant, it is marginal, unfortunately. Symbolically, it's very important, but in practical terms, all we're doing is postponing the evil day by a little bit, because every bit of carbon dioxide that we emit stays in the atmosphere for an average of 200 years. So it accumulates. So if you drove that car that distance, that carbon dioxide is added to the mass that is in the atmosphere. And at a certain point, you know, that mass goes up to what you get 2 degrees from. And after 2 degrees, you lose control because feedbacks kick in. The permafrost melts. The oceans give up their, you know, dissolved gases because they get warmer. Basically, nature takes over, and you're on an escalator that's taking you up to 5 or 6 degrees hotter, and you can't get off, even by cutting your emissions after the natural stuff kicks in. So, you know, we really do have to get our emissions down, and personal contributions in terms of changing lifestyle count, but be reasonable. This is a high-energy civilization, and it will live or die as one. There is no way 7 billion human beings can inhabit this planet as hunter-gatherers, right? We're going to have to maintain a very high energy use. What we have to do is change how we get the energy. Now, there's other implications to 7 billion human beings, but basically it's about energy, and there are ways to move.
Well, I wish we had more time to get into the ways to move, but unfortunately we're out of time. Gwynne Dyer, thanks so much for being my guest today.
You're Malcolm Watt. You're welcome, Matt.
That's nice of you. Gwynne Dyer, author of Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.